WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow marks the first anniversary of the storm on Mount Everest that killed 9 climbers from 4 expeditions in one day. 3 more climbers died by the end of the month. That was the most deaths in any one incident on the world's highest mountain. Journalist John Krakauer is one of the climbers who survived the storm. He was on assignment for Outside Magazine, writing about a new phenomenon, the guided climb, in which an expedition of high-paying amateurs is led by an experienced guide. The guide on the expedition Krakauer was writing about, Rob Hall, died in the storm. This was Krakauer's first time on Everest, but he's an experienced climber who has written about the danger and exhilaration of high-risk adventure. Now he has a new book about the Everest disaster called Into Thin Air. In Krakauer's expedition, 4 of the 6 people who made it to the top died. The 5th was severely frostbitten. Krakauer was the only one who survived without injury. I spoke with him last May, just a few days after he returned home to Seattle from the climb. I asked him why he thought he survived.
I don't know this. I mean, this is something that's haunted me since it happened. I mean, I would like to say that, you know, I was more experienced than the other clients or smarter or something, but I think when it comes down to it, I was just lucky. I've gone over it hundreds of times in my mind. I mean, there's some things I had in my favor, but the people who died, I mean, Rob Hall, much stronger climber than I am, another guy named Andy Harris. So I can't tell you. I mean, it's one of those things. Some people, why some people lived and some people died is a mystery that I think will trouble me for some time to come.
John, what were the first signs that you saw that a storm was coming?
It was when I reached the summit or shortly thereafter. You have to remember that all this is happening, you know, at 28, 29,000 feet. You're using bottled oxygen, but that brings the altitude effectively to maybe 27,000 feet. So you're hypoxic. Your brain is oxygen starved. And the effect of that is it's impossible to think clearly at that altitude. The whole thing seems like we were underwater. I mean, it was sort of dreamy and drugged in retrospect, things that should have seemed obvious at the time just didn't hit. And I remember getting to the summit and turning around and seeing clouds rising out of the valley. Since you're up higher than anything else, you're above most of the storm clouds. We were above the storm clouds. There's a lot of blue sky. It wasn't until the clouds rose to the level of the summit and engulfed us that we realized, oh, the weather's turning bad. I mean, if we'd looked down and we're thinking clearly, we could have seen it. But it wasn't until all of a sudden the clouds are over us, they've enveloped the mountain, it's a whiteout, it's starting to snow, that people began to realize, oh, this perfect day. And it started out as a perfect day, perfect conditions, perfect weather. That's when we began to realize, oh, we better get down fast.
Where were you and what time was it when you had this realization?
This was, again, I reached the summit about 1 o'clock. There were about 30 people, maybe a little less than that, climbing that day that set out from the camp at the South Col at 26,000 feet. We started climbing at 11:30 at night, so for the first 5-6 hours we're climbing in darkness. A moon rose over Makalu. It was beautiful. There was enough light from the half moon so we could turn off our headlamps and climb just by the light of the moon. Got to the summit about 1 in the afternoon. I was the second person. I was up in the front about 1 in the afternoon, and that's when the first clouds started moving in. I remember on the way down, I tagged the summit, turned around. I was running out of oxygen, so I was in a hurry. And almost the whole group I passed over the next hour, they were coming up. So we were all sort of bunched together. You know, it was high fives along the summit ridge, congratulating each other. There was no sense that anything was going wrong or was about to turn ugly. And then I moved off by myself. I started moving down. I had the experience to climb by myself, so I didn't wait for the rest of the party. I just started heading down, so I was one of the first people down. And I didn't see the group again until we got back down to our camp at the South Col.
So because you were ahead of everybody else, you managed to be ahead of the storm also?
Well, the storm caught me. I mean, by you know, the storm started. It didn't start violently. It was just this, you know, snow, clouds moved in. Climbers call it a whiteout, where all you can see is cloud. It's really hard to make out any features. But, you know, I've been in 1,000 storms like that, and all experienced climbers have. And as I got lower and lower in the mountain, the winds picked up until, by 3, 4, 5 in the afternoon, certainly. By 4, they were hurricane-force winds, just roaring, sounding like a Boeing 747, strong enough to knock you off your feet. I worried that there was so much snow being deposited by the wind that I worried about avalanches. You know, and this is a bitter cold wind, 100 below wind chill, so that any exposed skin, your cheeks, anything freezes very, very fast. And that alarmed me. I mean, I was taking it very seriously by that point, trying not to make a mistake. You know, if your hood falls off, blows off, if it is not buttoned correctly, you're gonna freeze all the skin on your face. So you've got to be really, really careful. And I was. And I made it down to just above the camp and paused over an icy section. At that point, I was caught by one of our guides, Andy Harris of New Zealand, who was in bad shape. He was sort of desperate and rushing down, and he passed me. And I saw him walk within 50 feet of the tents, and then the whiteout closed in. I didn't see him. I assumed he was at the tent and that he'd gone to bed. And the next morning, I realized that he never showed up at the tents and went out to look for him at 6 in the morning and spent an hour looking for him. I saw some crampon marks in the ice heading over the 4,000-foot Lhotse face, and I can only assume that he, in the storm and in his exhaustion, instead of taking a left turn for the tents, he kept going straight and walked right off the face. His body was never found.
So when you got down to the camp, was the storm really bad at the camp?
Oh, yeah. It was, you know, even in the camp with all your clothes on and your sleeping bag in a tent, I feared for my life. I mean, the tents are, they're being threatened to, they're, you know, they're being battered. You think they're going to blow apart. You're very cold. You've run out of oxygen. And it's not just, the oxygen also plays a huge part in keeping you warm. The physiology of, I mean, you need oxygen to keep warm. So when the gas turns off and the oxygen turns off, your hands get cold, your feet get cold. So even at camp, it was chaos. You couldn't talk from one tent to the other. No one knew who'd gotten down and who hadn't. Climbers were coming in the middle of the night, just finding a tent and piling into it. There were still, I think, about 10 or 12 climbers out as of midnight. They'd gotten down to the area of the tents, but they couldn't find the tents. And they were in desperate shape, just barely hanging on to their lives. One of the guides, Neil Biedelman, happened to, a little after midnight, catch a glimpse of the, you know, like a 15-second glimpse of where the tents were and dash for the tents with anyone who could walk. There were still 5 people left out there who were in such bad shape. They were just lying on the ice, comatose, unable to help themselves. And another guide, a Russian named Anatoly Bukharev, went back and heroically dragged 3 of them back. 2 he couldn't bring back. And one of those, Yasko Namba, died that night. The other, Beck Weathers, rescue party found him in the morning, and in sort of an act of triage, this rescue party found both Beck and this Japanese woman, and they were both barely alive, but they assumed they were going to die, and they were better off just leaving them there. So this rescue party decided to leave these 2 people there, and amazingly, 6 or 8 hours later, Beck Weathers kind of woke up and roused himself and walked into camp, you know, almost blind. He'd lost a mitten. One hand was, you know, completely frozen. That's sort of an amazing tale, how this guy saved himself.
My guest is journalist John Krakauer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with John Krakauer, recorded last May, several days after he returned home from the Mount Everest disaster. When you got back to base camp and realized that some of the other people in your party were not going to make it back, and that they were really trapped in the storm and weren't as capable as you were in getting down. What's the, I don't know if etiquette's the right word here, but what you must have felt like, oh, well, there must be something I could try to do to help them, and yet there was probably nothing you could possibly do. I mean, what goes through your mind about the responsibility toward the others who weren't making it?
Oh, I've gone through a lot of guilt, and I mean, I haven't resolved it yet, and that, you know, the night after we got back to our tents, if I'd really had my act together, if any of us had, you know, we could have been out there trying to rescue Yasuko Namba, this Japanese woman, and Beck, and who were at the call, and Yasuko died there. I mean, you know, she was two or three hundred yards away from camp when she died, and so you ask yourself, why didn't I, upon realizing she wasn't there, go out and search for her, search harder for her? I mean, there's a, you know, you have to deal with that a lot. I have to deal with that. There are things we could have done and didn't do. I mean, at the time, we were so messed up. You know, it was all I could do to get into my tent and just try to hang on myself. But in retrospect, you ask yourself, gee, maybe I could have saved her life.
But on the other hand, a couple of the leaders of the climb stayed behind to try to save people and died doing it.
Right. Yeah, Rob Hall, I'm sure, died because he stayed behind with a climber from Seattle, Doug Hansen, sort of collapsed on the summit ridge, and Rob stayed behind with him. I remember there was a radio call at 4:30 from base camp to Rob in which they suggested, you know, Doug's a goner. You should leave him and go. And Rob refused to do that. I mean, as a professional guide, he couldn't. As a person, he couldn't. And it ended up costing him his life. Rob held on throughout that night and into the next night. He was talking by radio much of that time. And we had considerable hope that he would make it down. We kept urging him, you know, come down, start down, just start down. And he would imply that he would. He said, okay, I'm packing up. And then an hour later, he'd get on the radio and we realized he hadn't left at all. He'd frostbitten his hands badly. In the upper part of the mountain, there's some technical sections, some ropes you have to descend, and he felt he couldn't safely descend those. So he decided to stay in the hope that a rescue team could come up to get him. But that was crazy. No one could get up. And sometime in the second night, the radio communications ended, and we assume that's when he died.
I guess for someone like Rob Hall, there were really no options. I mean, do you think that if he had tried to make it down the mountain, that because of his frostbitten hands and because of the storm, he never would have made it?
I think he might have. I think that in retrospect, that's what he should have done. I mean, even if he'd fallen, and he might have, better to fall than to stay up there and die. I mean, I don't know. I asked myself, well, what would I have done? And I like to think I would have headed down no matter what. I mean, as long as you're moving, you have a chance to stay up there. I mean, you know, no one could reach him. But he made a decision. I mean, again, he's without oxygen. He's run out of oxygen, you know, 24 hours earlier. He's not thinking as clearly as he might. He just kept saying, I'll be all right. Just send the boys, meaning the Sherpas, send the boys up with a couple thermoses of tea and I'll be fine. I mean, that's what he kept saying when we'd say, Rob, man, head down. Just start, pack up, go down now. And he would just say, no, can't do it, frostbitten hands. So, you know, that's part of the problem. Rob had really good judgment and he would lecture us earlier in the trip about the dangers of Everest and how the need to turn around when the weather looks bad, even if you're close to the summit, and how you shouldn't be foolish. And he sort of broke a lot of his own rules, and a lot of it probably has to do with being oxygen starved. I mean, that's all I can think.
Did you go to the memorial service?
There was one at base camp that we held. There's going to be others coming up. So, yeah, at base camp we had this impromptu memorial for the five climbers from our expeditions who died, and it was kind of a depressing and, I don't know, I had trouble with it. I mean, a lot of people stood up there and said, you know, Scott would have wanted us to carry on and let's not get depressed and, you know, think about the good things in life. And it just seemed like, you know, I don't know, I didn't buy it. I just thought, I got up and talked about Doug Hansen as this single parent with two kids now who don't have a father. And just sort of said, man, there's a lot more at stake here than just your own life. I mean, I was, you know, sort of addressing the climbers who had yet to go up, and there are some. There are some around the mountain now, and saying, think about Doug before you act rashly.
So I hadn't thought of that. So you thought you had a responsibility to the people who were first going to take the risk, and you're trying to talk some of them out of it.
Well, I don't know what I was trying to do. I was just depressed, and this sort of forced bonhomie, this forced good cheer about, mm-hmm. you know, Scott would have wanted us to carry on and think about, you know, to life and you know, no guts, no glory, or I don't know, this sort of, this good cheer, I just wasn't feeling cheerful. I was feeling severely depressed and maybe inflicted my depression on others. It didn't go over well. I mean, what I said, just sort of people kind of murmured and went on to the next guy. So, I don't know.
We've done several interviews, you and I, and it seems every time we talk, our conversation ends with reflections on high-risk adventure. And I would really like to hear what's going through your mind about that now. And I just want to say, too, that you're coming off of writing a book about somebody, a young man who went into the Alaskan wild and died there, never came out. So you chronicled his story, thought a lot about risk, and now you've just come back from Mount Everest in which, you know, what, 8 people died, and you're one of the ones who survived. So what are you thinking now about how much risk is worth taking for the adventure of mountain climbing or any other outdoor sport?
Right now, my head's in a really bad place, and I just think, I met the kids of Doug Hansen at the airport. I brought back his belongings from Nepal.
These are the kids who, he was a single father, and now he's dead,
right,
and his kids
right,
have no parents.
Right. And, you know, facing them, facing some of the other families of the deceased, risk, to look in their eyes, there's no way risk is worth it. I mean, if you survive and things go well, it's great. There are definitely benefits from taking chances. But right now, it just seems crazy and selfish and, can't be condoned. But having said that, I mean, I look at myself and I feel like sort of one of these, powerless to change. I'm compelled to take risk in the same way that Chris McCandless was the subject of this book. I mean, that book, I explore risk and the impulse to take it and to test yourself. And I don't really understand the impulse, but I understand it enough to know when it's there, it's sort of irresistible. For some people, it just defines them. It's an integral part of their life. They can't, it's just something they have to do. And I think I might be one of those people. I like to think that as I've gotten older, I've gotten smarter and the risk is more sort of, in my head or illusory, or I get the same charge without actually taking as much risk. But this Everest thing is really shaking me up. I mean, this is the first trip I've done where anyone died, and I sort of had to look at death at close range. And it's, I don't know, I'll be interested to see what effect it has on me. I don't think I'll quit climbing. I can tell you I don't think I'll ever go back to an 8,000-meter peak, to a big Himalayan peak. There's just too much misery, too much death, not enough pleasure. I mean, the pleasures I get of climbing aren't all risk. A lot of it is just the pleasure of being in the mountains, of moving on steep ground. I mean, there's a lot of joy in climbing normally. And this Everest trip, the ratio of joy to misery was just way too low. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what I'll do, how this will change me. It's way too soon. I just haven't come to grips with much of what happened there. So it'll be interesting to see whether I keep taking chances that I've taken in the past.
You were on Everest on assignment for Outside Magazine. Have you started writing the piece yet?
Haven't, and it's going to be hard to write. I have a lot of research to do still, a lot of phone calls just to try to iron out some details, what happened, talking to other people who are on the trip. So I don't know, writing is going to be difficult. I mean, I'm really close to the story. I'm really bent about it. I mean, I don't think you can write a piece under those conditions. So somehow I've got to shake myself out of this funk, get over this fever and come at it from a different angle.
What are you doing to try to shake yourself out of it? Or are you just trying to sit still and give everything time?
I mean, so really, since I got back, I mean, I was okay for about a day. I sort of had this euphoria where I just walked down on the beach near my house with my wife and kind of just kicked back, drank a lot. And then since then, this fever came on, and I've just been kind of depressed and spent yesterday in bed. I mean, I guess I've just got to give it a couple days and try to get it out of my system. But I haven't been myself. I've been kind of acting weird And I don't know. I'll try. If I don't get out of it in a couple of days, I'll try something different.
Have you been dreaming about the climb?
Yeah, I've had a lot of, almost every night I have nightmares about it involving, you know, sometimes just kind of thing, waking up out of breath, gasping, and I keep seeing Andy Harris wandering off into the mists. I mean, I'm troubled by this. This is something. I'm usually pretty well grounded, pretty centered. And this whole experience has really knocked my equilibrium off. So, you know, I don't have a clue yet how to get it back.
John Krakauer recorded last May, shortly after he returned home from Mount Everest. He's just completed a book about the disaster called Into Thin Air.